I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's February 25th, and we have a lot to talk about. I'm on my way to West Palm Beach, Florida, to attend the ACTRIMS Forum. ACTRIMS is an acronym that stands for the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis. And this year's conference gets underway on Thursday, with more than 1,200 MS research scientists and clinicians expected to attend. It's always been my goal to keep you updated on all the research news and announcements as they're being made. So as we try to do at all the major MS research conferences, you can expect to hear bonus episodes of Real Talk MS later this week. Before we move on, I have some difficult news to share with you. In past episodes of Real Talk MS, you've heard me talk about my wife Jean, who was diagnosed with secondary progressive MS in 1997. Unfortunately, Jean's MS symptoms were particularly vicious, and her disease progression seemed relentless. But I don't think that MS realized what sort of a fight it was in for when it picked on a hot-tempered Italian girl from New Jersey. And while Jean battled back with everything she had, it wasn't quite enough. As I've said before, MS takes no prisoners. This past Wednesday, my wife Jean lost her battle with MS and passed away. To be honest with you, I'm still processing all of this. But I've always told you the truth. I've always tried to be 100% transparent. And I couldn't imagine not sharing this news with you. I know I'll have more to share with you about Jean's story and our story as a family impacted by progressive MS, but that's going to have to come another day. What I will say is that the biggest reason that I participate as a member of the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, and the biggest reason that I spend time advocating on behalf of everyone affected by MS, and the biggest reason that I speak at conferences and events and lead research projects focused on the well-being of MS care partners is that I hope that my efforts will somehow play a small part in making sure that other families won't have to experience everything that Jean and I have. I've never asked for financial support for this podcast, and I never will. But this year, I'm participating in the National MS Society's Walk MS to honor Jean. And I'm asking you to join me in honoring Jean and the nearly 1 million children, teens, and adults living with MS in the United States by making a donation to Walk MS. I've created an online shortcut to the secure online donation page, so you just have to point your browser at realtalkms.com/walkms, and I'll be sure to include that link in today's show notes. And let me say a quick but heartfelt thank you to Elizabeth and Bruce and Paul and Jeffrey and Barry and John and David and Yvonne and Diane and so many of you who have already made a donation. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your generosity and your support. As I've mentioned during the past couple of podcast episodes, next week I'll be in Washington, D.C. along with about 300 MS activists participating in the National MS Society's Public Policy Conference. In last week's podcast episode, we heard from Barry Talenti, the Executive Vice President of Advocacy for the National MS Society, and Barry broke down each of the legislative issues that we'll be talking about with our members of Congress and asking for their support. This week, my guest is Diane Kramer, an MS activist who's going to be attending the Public Policy Conference for the first time. And I think Diane has experienced some of the very same frustrations that so many people living with MS experience on a regular basis. Insurance companies preventing her from getting the disease-modifying therapy that her neurologist prescribed. Having the high cost of her MS medication force her to make nearly impossible financial choices and even choosing to skip treatment. But whether she's knocking on the doors of neurologists' offices in her area to connect them with resources from the MS Society, or starting a support group in her community when she found there wasn't one, Diane is a force to be reckoned with, and she's a difference maker. I'm looking forward to being with her at next week's Public Policy Conference, and in a moment, we'll meet my guest, Diane Kramer. Well, my guest today is Diane Kramer. Welcome to the podcast, Diane.
Hi, John.
Diane, you were diagnosed with MS in 2010, and I thought we could start our conversation talking about your MS journey. So tell me a little bit about what was going on in your world in 2010. What were you doing at the time? And what kinds of things went through your mind once you received your diagnosis?
Sure. So I was working as a nurse here in central Pennsylvania at a small aesthetic practice where we did surgery and lasers and skincare and all sorts of neat stuff. And I was seeing my own patient load. I was 27 years old and my 5-year-old daughter had just started kindergarten. And I started losing the feeling in my toes and my left foot. And then I started losing feeling in the fingers of my left hand. And I was just doing the horrible nurse thing where I was just walking it off and saying, everything's fine. And I started having these weird clusters of headaches too. So my husband said, you really need to get in to see a doctor. I said, no, I'm a nurse. I know better. I can do this on my own. He said, no, you're going to the doctor. I'm driving you. So I went in and saw my primary care doctor who immediately got me in for a CT scan to rule out a brain tumor. I was concerned because it was just one side of my body and I was having so much numbness that something bigger was going on. And that primary care doctor, as soon as my CT scan came back, and it was not a brain tumor, he pulled a paper towel out of the dispenser that was in front of him and slapped it down on the desk. And he wrote three things. He wrote thyroid cancer, leukemia, MS. And he said, what you have going on with these headaches, this numbness, this fatigue, the other, you know, assorted symptoms going on, it's one of these three things. And he made me an appointment for an MRI and a bunch of blood work. I went to the neurologist. I had my MRI, and we had talked about some different things and had that initial appointment, but the neurologist wasn't saying one way or another until about a week later. The neurologist called me while I was at work and said, I'm so sorry, but you have MS.
So after you were diagnosed, I know your neurologist prescribed a specific disease-modifying therapy for you, but what happened when you tried to obtain that medication that your doctor had prescribed?
So my very first disease modifier was denied by my insurance because I had not failed a disease modifier first. And even being a nurse and having some sort of idea of insurance companies, I had no frame of reference for what I needed to be doing, if I could do anything, what my options were for disease modifiers. The insurance company literally would choose my disease modifier for me. So a second disease modifier was approved. And it was an injectable, especially in 2010. We were doing a lot more with the injectables then. And a nurse came to our house and showed my husband, did injection training with my husband. And I would stay on that medication for 3 months. After that 3-month period, my insurance changed and my first neurologist and that disease modifier were no longer covered.
So you not only lost the continuity of care from losing the ability to see the neurologist who had been treating you, but you also lost the medication you were on.
Exactly.
And the one that I had just kind of gotten into the rhythm of doing and, you know, staying consistent and how my side effects were going.
So what did you do?
So the new insurance company told me that another neurologist in another town 40 miles away was a participant with my insurance. So I went to them and started all over again with having to have a new disease modifier, going through the motions of all of that and seeing this second neurologist and kind of trying to feel out what to do next. Not long after my first visit with that neurologist, I received a phone call, and it was a woman that identified herself as my care coordinator. And John, I was pumped, like somebody who is going to figure out what's going on and tell me what to do next. And I just started talking to her, like, I don't know what to do. I'm not sure what to tell my 5-year-old. You know, how do we do this? And she stopped me and she said, I'm calling from your insurance company. The reason I'm calling is to let you know what your co-pays will be. And it just took the breath right out of me. I could not believe that I was still not getting anywhere. Nobody was listening.
I know you eventually reached out to an MS Navigator, and I've talked about this before. I think the MS Navigator program is truly remarkable, but tell me about your experience speaking with an MS Navigator.
So after I had that conversation with the care coordinator from the insurance company, I had a second follow-up appointment with my neurologist, and he told me that he, based on what he was seeing as a really rapid progression, he thought that I was going to be in a wheelchair within the year. He followed that up by sending a catalog of durable medical equipment, things like wheelchairs and hospital beds, to my home so that I could prepare for that. And you know, wind out of the sails doesn't even begin to describe it. You feel awful because you have MS symptoms going on. Nobody is telling you what to do. And then a catalog of wheelchairs shows up. Like, it's just not going so great. And I picked up that magazine, and I started flipping through it, and in the back was an ad for the MS Society. And it had the website, nationalmssociety.org. And I immediately got online, and I found the MS Navigator program, and that is where my story starts. Because connecting with them allowed me to take control back and to really determine what we were going to do next, by equipping me with resources and information and homework. You know, take a look at this, take a look at that. The MS Navigators would talk me through self-referring to a comprehensive care center that was out of state, and I started going there.
Part of your story involves some challenges that a lot of people with MS have in terms of accessibility to their medication. In fact, just a few weeks ago, the MS Society released the results of a nationwide survey about access to MS medications, and one of the more startling outcomes that the survey revealed was that about 40% of the survey respondents said that they were either delaying or skipping treatment with disease-modifying therapy due to the high cost of the drugs, due to the high cost of their portion of the payment for those drugs. Now, I understand that you've actually faced some of those challenges.
The accessibility. Medication is only as good as if you are actually taking it. And I was finding over and over that I was not having accessibility to medications, not just physically, like not being able to get to an infusion site that was nearby or having trouble getting medication shipped to me or any of that, but actually getting the ability to pay for it. Because I didn't have that connection, especially earlier on, through the MS Navigators to help me with copay assistance programs or different foundations or working with different formularies. I had no idea how to do any of that. I did resort to taking doses inappropriately, changing the way that I was taking things so it would last a little bit longer. I had to make the choice at one point to not fill a prescription at all. And with MS, we can't afford to wait to treat MS. Time is brain, and I don't know what the effects of that was. It would take a nurse who was part of the clinical care team that I was seeing. She really stepped up and said, I need to know that you are taking these medications as ordered, and if you are not, I need you to tell me why. And she and I developed a relationship where I could tell her the really hard stuff. The hard stuff like, I'm not sure how we're going to pay our heating bill. I'm not sure if I can pay this. That uncertainty was always looming. And being able to have someone that could really one-on-one break it down with me and keep me compliant was life-changing.
A lot of what you've just mentioned is important stuff. It's difficult stuff. First, I appreciate you sharing all of it with us. But I think it's something that so many people living with MS face all the time. And one of the things you've done is you've also made the decision to become an MS activist. And I know I'll be seeing you soon at the MS Society's public policy conference in Washington, D.C. So tell me a little bit about what made you decide to become an MS activist, and what would you share with other people affected by MS about becoming an MS activist?
You know, John, early on in my diagnosis, probably within about 3 or 4 months, my husband and I sat down and we were really talking about MS and what were we going to choose to do as far as what was our party line going to be? Who were we telling? What were we telling? And we made the decision then to live our fight transparently, the good, the bad, the ugly. And so I've done that from the very beginning. You know, if I've had flares or I've been hospitalized, people know. Everybody knows. If there's somebody that asks questions, everybody knows. I always answer them fully, and I do that because I didn't have somebody in the beginning that I could relate to or that was, I felt like, giving me a real life experience. So this past year, it became apparent that I was sharing my story so much that I could do it in a completely different realm than I had ever done before. And I could share it and make a political impact, because the stories weren't being told in the right way or to the right people, that wasn't being heard. And so I went to my first state action day here in Pennsylvania in September, and I went and met not just with my elected officials, but other Pennsylvania elected officials, and shared my story about the failure of step therapy, about the desperate need for prior authorization reform, and shared that and kind of put a face to that. And then I kept in touch with those elected officials. I don't believe that I need to go and see somebody just when I have something to ask them. So I have had my in-district meetings throughout over the Christmas or holiday break. I went to some of my elected officials and just caught up with them and told them about the new things that were going on in our area, in the MS community, new research that's out, and just trying to pull everybody together, because it's going to take all of us. You know, it's going to take our entire MS community to have that end goal of our cures for MS. And we have to do something in between. And for me, I just can't sit back and let people assume or let people fill in the blanks when I can be sharing my story instead.
So for people who aren't familiar with the Public Policy Conference, the centerpiece of the conference is our Day on the Hill. And that's when about 300 of us literally hit the halls of Congress, meet with our elected senators and representatives, and talk about the issues that are most important to people affected by MS. Things like having access to quality healthcare, things like making sure that we're protected with our pre-existing conditions by the laws that are in place, making sure that the cost of MS medications is still within the grasp of people who need them. So all those things considered, what are some of your goals for the time you're going to spend in D.C.?
So I think some of you've covered so many of them there, but the two big ones for me are the prior authorization and step reform and having that access to medications. That's the biggest thing for me, because prior authorization and fail first is what we call it. You take one medication because you have to, and knowing that it might not be the best medication. Those policies set people up for failure, and it becomes a very frustrating, why bother kind of mentality. Why bother following up with my neurologist the way that I should be, just knowing that I'm not going to be able to have this medication that they say that I need anyway. So that's a really big step for me, and a really big part of my personal goals and personal story. The other thing that's very important to me is surprise medical billing. Surprise medical billing is something that I have very more recent experience with. I've had a lot of these issues happen, but sharing my story of surprise medical billing, when I was on a disease modifier that had already been pre-authorized, but the pre-authorization was only good for 6 months, and that was how often I was having the disease modifier, and the prior authorization lapsed. Then there was a change with the infusion site. Long story short, I got a surprise medical bill 4 months after the disease modifier was given to me for $8,500.
That's a very bad surprise.
That's the worst kind of surprise. I just was stunned, because I wasn't expecting it, because everything leading up to that said, you've had this multiple times before. Why would you need this reauthorized? Why? And it just, everything was all go. So those are the two kind of policies that really get my blood pressure up a little bit. But I'm also really, really excited to be going to public policy this year to meet so many different people affected by MS from other areas. Because I have not been to a more national event until now, that's a huge thing for me because we have so many connections, so many different states, and it just having that kind of fraternity of fighting MS is just wonderful. It changes everything.
Well, I agree. And having been to a few of these, I can tell you, you're going to meet a few hundred people that bring the same energy and passion that you do to our work. So you're going to be a great addition, I know, to the conference.
I appreciate that.
You just mentioned something about the fact that there is strength in fraternity. And in addition to your work as an activist in Pennsylvania and soon to be an MS activist in Washington, D.C., I know you've also launched the State College MS Connection Group. Can you tell me a little bit about that group?
I absolutely can. So I live here in State College, Pennsylvania, right in the middle of the state. And we did not have a support group for people affected by MS directly in State College. It was just kind of a void. And so about 6 months ago, I was getting contacted through Facebook and different social media. Hey, I have MS. Is there a group? Can we get together? And I started meeting with people one-on-one. And, you know, we'd go for coffee or we'd go for a beer and we would go for a walk and I would just listen. And I met people that had been diagnosed 4 months before and people that had been diagnosed 22 years before. It was just this huge realm of people and all of them were saying the same thing. We need more information. We don't know about different resources and we have no one that's listening. So I said, well, how about let's start a group? So I went through the training with the National MS Society. They have a fantastic support group leader training. I went through, talked about all sorts of different resources. And then January 9th, we launched with our first meeting. And our topic was resilience and to listen to the people sharing their experiences. Resilience is strong with the MS community. It's amazing what these people are doing, what they're living with, how they're living their lives with young families or, you know, kids that have moved away. And they're just doing life so well. So how do we perpetuate that? And I don't want to sugarcoat it and say that we just talked about how wonderful life is. We talked about, too, side effects of disease modifiers. We talked about finances. We talked about the hard stuff. We talked about sex. We talked about making the decision to try and say, I think I need to see a urologist because I'm pretty sure I shouldn't be going to the bathroom 5 times a night. You know, these are hard conversations to have, but they're easier when they're shared among your peers.
Since you mentioned meeting with people who became group members one-on-one initially, I know you've also done some one-on-one work with doctors. I understand you have actually gone door-to-door to doctors' offices in an effort to better connect them with MS resources. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can. This is kind of one of my where I feel like my story here kind of goes a little bit. I'm not crazy, I promise. So what was happening was I was talking to people about the resources that are so essential when you are first diagnosed. And I can right off the top of my head know that I know there's three things that were so essential to me and that I wanted to be able to equip everyone who was newly diagnosed with. And that was the MS Navigator information, Momentum Magazine, and the Knowledge is Power program, which is a webinar. It's a series of webinars about all sorts of different topics that are important when you are going through early diagnosis. They're actually important now. I love to go back through the program from time to time because there's things about parenting, different things, issues. So there's three big essential resources so that we were no longer doing things like calling people at work and saying, I'm sorry, but you have MS and I'll see you in a month. I wanted to change that because it was still happening. So I sent out to all of my area doctors, neurologists, primary care, physical therapist, everyone. I sent them all a letter and I said, hi, my name is Diane and I live with multiple sclerosis here in the center region. I would like to pass on some information to you. I'm including it in this letter. I will be following up with your office in the next week or so to make an appointment and come in and see you. And out of the over 100 letters that I sent, I only heard back from two places. So I started making phone calls, and out of all of that, I ended up making appointments at about 10 different local offices and saying, I just need you for 3 minutes. I'm not selling you anything. I don't actually work for anyone. I just want to give you this information so that if you ever see somebody who has MS, you have this information. And that's gone really, really well. I haven't been able to get into everywhere that I want to. Some of the places were so excited to meet somebody who was willing to share resources. And I got them hooked up with our patient educator that works for the MS Society, and are they're going through the process of becoming a partner in MS care doctor and being one of those that's promoted as having that next level of multiple sclerosis knowledge. So that was just huge, huge to hear. And I have had people that have contacted me and said, I saw your support group because of a flyer somewhere. And it's just getting the word out there, making those connections for people.
Diane, the work you've done, not only on your own behalf, but on behalf of the community of people who are living and affected by MS in your area and soon to be nationwide, is extraordinary. So let me thank you for all of that. And thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, John.
This week's episode of Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. If you have a friend or family member who might also enjoy listening to the podcast, you can share this episode with them by suggesting they point their web browser at realtalkms.com/130. That's realtalkms.com/130. And you'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. I hope you'll take just a minute to visit realtalkms.com/walkms and make a donation toward WalkMS. The MS Society is the largest private funder of MS research in the world, and I think supporting their efforts just makes a lot of sense. So I'm inviting you to help. Just visit realtalkms.com/walkms and you'll find that link in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. And we'll catch you next time.